the good life is you have shaped your world to be the kind of world that you want, and it's sacred to you and beautiful to you, and it works. It works in fact, and you've done it, and it has meaning, and that's it. And you get your 80 years, and then you're off.
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. This podcast is a venue for me to follow my curiosity through conversations with leading thinkers and builders. My guest today is Matt Bateman. Matt is the Vice President of Pedagogy at Higher Ground Education. We talk about pedagogy, Montessori, capability and agency in children, experimentation in education, how young education is as a science, the importance of work, and a conception of the good life. Please enjoy.
Did you leave academia for a reason that was for a negative aspect about academia, or was it more so you were moving towards this new opportunity in space?
I would say first and foremost, it was negative. So, not that I was like an anxious wreck and was just running away from something, but just in the sense of, there was a kind of like skill/character issue where I never really felt like I mastered the research part of academia, and it was becoming increasingly important as I was increasingly heading towards something like a tenure track position. And I just realized I was so grad school is hard, and then being on the job market is hard. So there are a bunch of hard things about academia. And when I was kind of frustrated and depressed about those things, I was like, of course I'm frustrated and depressed. Like, it's hard. Like, you're supposed to be frustrated and depressed. And then I was starting to have kind of more success. I was a visiting professor at a university that I really liked, and things were kind of lining up in a certain way. And I was just like, I was still kind of depressed about it. I'm like, the success case is that I do this for another 60 years, and I'm not sure that that's what I want to do with my life. So I started putting out feelers at that point. And, but it was also like, I was a little bit different from a lot of other people that I met in academia, and that I always knew that there were lots of things that I would be excited to do. Typically, if you do a PhD program in the humanities, the expectation is that you're going to try to become a tenure track professor in the humanities somewhere or other, and that this is your life. And I was always like, yeah, like, that seems good, and I'll try to do that. But I was never worried about other things. I had a kind of prior careers and jobs and things and other things that I was excited about.
To set the context for a majority of this conversation, I'd love to understand better why you gravitated towards Montessori as kind of the foundational philosophy that you were building up from or experimenting from. What was it about Montessori? And maybe to juxtapose that to some other philosophy out there, you might even argue there aren't that many that are as comprehensive as Montessori.
And there are other approaches. Yeah. It's hard to find kind of like really coherent, worked out philosophies with implementation schemas that scale, but there are other approaches out there. So I've worked in preschools. I worked in a preschool in college. We had a lab school attached to my college, and I did a lot of teaching there, and it was good. And it was what any parent would typically regard as a good school. It had toddler classes and early childhood classes. It had twos, threes, and fourths classes. There were some fives too that were pre-K, and I taught at every level. It was volunteer work, but I spent a lot of time there. And the structure of the class was, you come in, you'd be playing outside, then you'd come inside and you'd have a snack, and then you'd have about 90 minutes of semi-structured play where there were different stations in the room. There would be like a sand and water station and a dress-up station and a box station and a reading station. And like every like 20 minutes or something like that, like students would have to pick a new station. So they'd kind of be circulated amongst the stations and get some variety. And that, so you'd do like four things like that. And then there was another snack, and the rest of the day was collective exercises, kind of group, circle time, songs, dance, music, reading stories, that kind of thing. And so that was my kind of, that's what I thought of as good. I have a lot of experience with children babysitting. I have kind of pretty clear memories of my own childhood of what's good and what's bad. And then I saw a Montessori classroom for the first time about 10 years ago. And it just, I guess what that experience did was it took what I thought of as like the best parts of my childhood, like where I was building a treehouse or playing with Legos, or like where I had taught myself how to draw and like figured out shading, and like just like I was on about something and excited about it and really passionate about it. And it was, I mean, it kind of felt like work and play were indistinguishable, and I was really focused and I was getting new competencies and I felt really good about myself. That's what the Montessori classroom was doing, except it was a classroom. And just that was inconceivable to me. Before I saw it, I thought like, yeah, like at school you learn some things and there's some value and you have some fun socializing, but like the real value probably happens. You can't get that, maybe rarely, but you certainly can't systematically get that experience of like, I've been obsessing over Legos for 3 hours and I'm in deep focus and I'm happy and I'm learning things and all these things are coming together. That's not school. And in the Montessori classroom that I saw, it was school. It was a 3-6 classroom. There were 24 students. It was full. There were two teachers for 24 students. Teachers are kind of wandering around with a gentle touch, giving presentations, giving little bits of advice, giving little bits of help. And the students were, each and every one of them, focused on something where they were really goal-oriented and really learning. And it wasn't like they were playing board games or they were having fun socializing. They were like laying out 100 flags onto a map of the world, or writing really complex sentences for a 4-year-old using the movable alphabet on a big mat and kind of reading them out to their friend. And I mean, everybody was doing something like this. And it wasn't like this unicorn teacher. I mean, the teacher was very good. I've gotten to know her. She was like, 24 and pretty fresh out of her teacher training. And I was just like, what is this? And then I spent the last 10 years doing is like investigating that question. What is this? What is this thing that I saw? And some of the principles behind it. I mean, that's the, so in terms of just the answer to the question of like what drew me to Montessori, it was the outcomes. Like it was like just seeing an actual classroom that did things that I didn't think that classrooms could do, and really shook me up in terms of what an education could and should do. The features that draw me to it are that it's very high agency, very respectful of the children's autonomy and choices of motivation, but it's also extremely competence driven, and it connects those two things. So it it's not like a trade-off of like it's fun or you're actually learning something. It's like really both. And that's hard to find in it. I mean, even as a college professor, I kind of felt like, to what extent am I doing projects that the adult students are interested in? And to what extent am I kind of really teaching them to standards, and how do I mix those things? And is there a balance? And Montessori just solves that problem. But there are a million other things too. I mean, I love the beautiful environments. I love the linking of the practical and the theoretical. I like the fact that like cooking is taken seriously, but so is math and language. And if you kind of really follow the Montessori principles and develop it, you'll come up with things very naturally, as we have, that like links cooking and chemistry and things like that. So it's just it's a high structure framework and a high agency framework, and that's just hard to find.
A lot of the tactics and mechanisms that people associate with Montessori, like for example, I was listening to a previous podcast episode you had done where you were talking about the almost miniature IKEA furniture for kids.
So Montessori she kind of invented in the 1900s, early 1900s, this idea of child-sized furniture. And she like contracted with carpenters and had it built. And people were like, what is this, like furniture for dolls? What are you doing? She's like, no. Like I want to make a house for children where they can be really independent. And now everybody has that. Every home has that. Every preschool has that. Right. It's just a kind of normal thing. But yeah, like there's a reason why Montessori was the pioneer in this area. And it's because she kind of took a principled view of the domain and really understood the child's nature. And so, yeah, I think whenever you see like a Fisher Price table and chair for a little kid, that is, and very indirectly, an expression of Montessori's genius in terms of identifying that like children can do real things and need spaces that are prepared for them.
This dovetails nicely into the question I wanted to ask, which is, what is the foundation of that principled approach to education and learning and development that you feel like a lot of, not to stereotype here, but traditional public education is lacking?
I mean, it's the idea that children are capable, when you just kind of say that line, it sounds very trite. It sounds like,
right,
everybody thinks that I believe in children. But like, no, really, children are capable. Children can build things. Children can make things. Children can cook things. Children can learn things. If you leave children alone, like, they won't all, like, just go to the candy bowl and destroy the house. Like the kind of natural, I mean, this is, I mean, a lot of this is based on observation. So one of the things that distinguishes Montessori is this very careful observation under pretty controlled conditions. Not that the child was controlled, but that you kind of set up, a certain kind of school environment for the child. And then continually optimize that such that you can give them a large amount of freedom and kind of see what happens under optimal circumstances. But it's this really deep and abiding belief that children are capable, that they're that they're the ones driving their learning and education, that they're creating the adults that they're turning out to be, that the child is the creator of the man. And that that includes things like, I mean, a one-year-old, a zero-year-old, I mean, I've got a seven-month-old that I've been, you know, I just came off of a paternity leave a couple months ago. He would, when he was 6 weeks old, concentrate very intentionally on something that he found interesting for 25, 30 minutes. That rolls into fiddling with a little learning material for 30 minutes until you've got it kind of sorted in the right place. I've got videos of my children doing this, not because my children are exceptional or geniuses or anything like that, but just because they were set up in the right way and children naturally find goals that express their sense of efficacy and exercise their faculties, and sorting activities are great for children of this age. And then that rolls into, my daughter is three now and she's learning how to read, and there's a curriculum that's been prepared specially for her such that she can obsess over each letter and kind of learn, connect them to sound games that she's also very, very interested in, and connect those things to stories that she's interested in. So there's a really evidentially substantiated belief in children that they're more capable of focus, of real goals, of learning, of competencies than, especially young children, than all children. But I mean, the idea that a three-year-old could read, nobody, the wealthiest person in the world would not teach a three-year-old to read in 1900. And Montessori taught a bunch of slum children how to read. And it wasn't by drills. And it's just like, there's just a different, it was her belief that children were capable that let her see that that was possible.
What's the root of our general underestimation of children? Is it a fear that they won't amount to anything unless we intervene and control and guide? Why don't more of us think this way?
I mean, I think that the main reason is that children are alien. Like, they're very different. Small children are very different from adults in how they learn and how they operate. And there's a few different things. One is they're very different. Two is that they learn a lot of what they need to know without adult intervention. So, like, I mean, every child learns how to speak and fluently, their kind of native language, their mother tongue. And you can just kind of forget about it. Whereas, like you can't, there's certain things, like, if you're an educator now, like, it's not just like children just happen to learn how to read and happen to learn their multiplication tables. You got to work. You got to provide some structure. But a lot of the incredible things that very small children learn seems to take no effortful help from adults. So you can afford to forget about it. And then the third thing is that, this is also very real to me as a parent, children are annoying. I mean, I love children. I love my children. But like, the reality is, if you're a caretaker, you're spending a lot of time trying to figure out how to get children to not, like, throw a temper tantrum for apparently no reason because they asked for a cheese stick and you gave them a cheese stick and now they're mad at you. And you're just like, I mean, like, a lot of interactions with children are because, and this is because they're alien, because they work very differently, because they have a sense of order. I mean, Montessori has a whole theory of this, but like, if you don't really understand children, and I don't even think I've studied children for 10 years, I have children, I don't think that I understand children exceptionally well. They're hard to understand. You will frequently find yourself in power struggles and frustrating positions. And it just, and the kind of feeling, overwhelming feeling, is like, children aren't capable. They're kind of random, crazy people that, like, can't get out the door in any, you know, anything less than an hour and 45 minutes, and, like, you know, would starve if I didn't harass them to eat, right? I mean, that it's not crazy to feel that way. And so it takes real kind of diligence and careful thought and careful observation to understand that that's not fundamental to children, that the kind of the framework that you're seeing all those things through is not, it doesn't just, you don't just, you're not reading that off of children. There's a whole theory that children are incapable that you kind of have to undermine and work through. And then you'll start to see that, oh, two-year-olds actually have a sense of order. And the reason why they're really upset when you give them the cheese stick is that the cheese stick had a small flaw and they're barely capable of predicting the world around them, just barely. And they're so excited to do it, but it's really fragile. And they're actually really threatened when something goes a little bit wrong. And this is the way that they're processing that. And this is a natural phase. It's a kind of, it flows out of their deep capabilities, their cognitive capabilities that are blooming very young. But I mean, and you can say a lot more about that kind of thing, but that's like, it's just hard to see that, I think.
My daughter turned 2 a week and a half ago, and I probably arrived at this, I wouldn't even call this a theory. It's maybe closer to a truth. But I arrived at this year and a half ago. I was trying to pinpoint or kind of distill what is the root challenge as a parent and like the objective. And it really came down to this striking this balance between putting up guardrails, intervening, guidance, whatever you want to call it, versus independence and freedom of the child. And I'm curious the balance you found between those two things, both as a teacher and a parent, and maybe what are the key models or heuristics you use to identify when do I step in versus when do I identify this is something they need to struggle with, they need to kind of strike out on their own?
I would say I don't really think about guardrails. I don't like the language of guardrails and limits. Okay. But I do think about kind of environmental structure and support. And so, you know, what is the routine? Like, does my daughter clean up after herself when she eats? She doesn't. I have to clean up and then I have to nag her and do it. And everybody hates it, right? It's like, I hate nagging her. She hates cleaning up. Is there something that we can do in the environment that would make her more excited to clean up? Could we set up a whole shelf with cleaning supplies? Could we, clean with her? Could we, some of it is limits. Some of it is like, okay, like we're not turning on the movie after dinner until everything is clean, because that's what we do. Like, we clean in the house, and like, we don't present it as a punishment, but it is just like, you don't move on to the next thing before cleaning the previous thing. And that's a kind of structure too. It's a kind of social structure. But the routine, I mean, routines and behaviors follow the environment. This is a Montessori principle. And so there's often things that you can do that sound very implausible. It sounds like, if I set things up that way, there's no way that my kid would care about it. But it does work. Like, it really does work, where a child will be more excited to learn how to use the toilet if they have a step stool that they can go to, and there's a little mirror where they can watch themselves, and there's a million things like that. So in terms of the other part of your question was kind of like, sometimes children do things that they're not capable of and they're struggling and they get frustrated, and do you help them? I mean, yeah, I help my children all the time, especially when they ask for it or when they're like overtly, like, you know, beyond the pale, kind of frustrated and crying. I do think that most parents, for very understandable reasons, their instincts are to help too soon. And they're not actually that attuned to how frustrated their child is. So the fact that a child's been doing something for 5 minutes and hasn't succeeded in doing it yet, if you're watching them as a parent, you're frustrated. It's a frustrating thing to watch, especially if it's like a little thing and you could give them a little bit of help. That does not, like, unless they're actually, you have to ask yourself, are they actually frustrated? Or are they just like trying again and they're fine and they've got a look of focus and maybe they're a little bit frustrated, but it's fine. Like, have they asked you for help? Like, have they shown any signs of giving up? Like, you know, children give up. Yeah, children ask for help. But there's a big mid range of cases where children could keep struggling, where, it's harder for the parents than it is for the child. And just knowing that fact can change a lot about how you parent. Just in terms of, like, I let my children, I mean, I show my wife videos of things that, like, I let my daughter do. And she's just like, what the, like, why did you let her jump down those stairs like that? Like, what if she had fallen? And so, I mean, I'm pretty far on the, like, free range side of, like, you know, if it's anything less than a hospital visit is the reasonable worst case scenario, I'll probably let my child do it. But then, you know, I'm not going to let them run into traffic.
One of the underpinnings of Montessori, as I understand it, is you don't make trade-offs between trying to direct the child and helping nurture agency within them? Do you believe that those are kind of two sides of the same thing, or at least they should be taught in an integrated way? And I juxtapose that maybe a little bit with, I imagine if you haven't read it, you're at least familiar with Summerhill School.
Sure.
Yeah. And the school itself, which is kind of the taken to an extreme, the idea of student-led everything and freedom, and they'll come to learn things of their own accord when they're ready. How does Montessori think differently about this kind of balance between this kind of continuing to pull on this thread we were just talking about, but Montessori think differently about combining instruction and guidance with nurturing agency, and kind of where does that fall on the spectrum from, like, you know, traditional education, which is much more handholding and instructor led, versus like Summerhill School, which is just almost anarchic in a sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think on the whole, I mean, maybe one of two very fundamental tensions in the history of education is that it does seem like there's a trade-off between those two things. And so it's like either you're giving drills, you're telling the students what to do, you're being very directive, and the students are learning, they're freaking learning, but, you know, they hate it and they hate you. And, you know, that's overstating the dynamic. Like, it can be better than that. But I mean, you know, we have like letters from parents and students in the 3rd century BCE complaining about, you know, how authoritarian school is. And it's like basically reads like it could be read today. Or it's like, you let children have fun, you let kids be kids, you let them grow up, but like, they don't actually learn as much. They do learn some things. If you just kind of let children run free, they will learn some things. But like, how ambitious is it? And for every student, like, you know, some students are really ambitious self-starters and learners. Is every student, is the median student like gonna make those choices, as opposed to like socializing or playing video games or, you know, some of the easier pleasures or learning activities? Are they really going to push themselves? Often the answer is no, kind of without other actions or activities. It's not, Montessori's theory is not like children are naturally want to learn, and so if you just set them free, they'll learn. The theory is that there are inputs you can give to a child's experience: the environment, certain kinds of curriculum, a certain kind of social structure, a certain kind of school culture, that function as like synthetic rocket fuel. Like, so if everybody else is like you know, they're like powered by, you know, eating like normal food, like, it's just like, no, like this is like way better for your learning and children. And both in the sense that children, now kind of relating it to agency, so just in the sense of how effective it is at teaching children things, but that children will choose it. Like, they will sense like, oh, this will make me really efficacious, I'm really excited to do this. So just at the front end, they will choose it. Sometimes you got to coax them, sometimes you got to sell them on it, and you're always trying to get them to choose it voluntarily. So it's never like, you must do this or else. Not never, never, but that's the kind of exceptional case. It's the remedial case. Like, in a kind of baseline case with a child, it's sales. It's not kind of like discipline. But more than that, I think a lot of the agency doesn't live in the initial choice. And there's this, a lot of the way that people think about agency in education, and I think Summerhill is a good example of this, is you have agency if you can pick what you want from the menu. And Montessori thinks, sure, like, you have to be able to pick what you want from the menu, but there's also a lot of agency in how you eat it. And sounds kind of silly with that example, but just the kind of, if you think about a child eating something that they pick from a menu, there's a lot of intentional control and inhibition and excitation and executive function in like eating it and eating it well and eating it gracefully and following through and like what you're mindful of. And then even as adults, it's like, why am I eating this meal? Is it because is it really a social event? Is it to be nutritious? Like, what are my goals here? How do I balance them? Was I as intentional as I could be? Like, kind of how you carry out the choices that you carry out is hugely a matter of agency. Agency is self-direction. It's not just selection. And if that's the way that you see the child's learning, it's not so much like, I will let the child do what he or she wants to do, though that choice at that level is important and you have to be thoughtful about that. It's more like, how do you give the child the opportunity to persist for an hour and feel an increasing sense of efficacy right. with every step? And that is a hard instructional design challenge. Like that does not just, this is, that's the thing that doesn't usually happen naturally. Yeah. And so that's where the kind of education comes in.
So if you can kind of constrain the option set, or at least create an environment such that you can cultivate agency, they can learn that kind of conscientiousness. And then down the road, maybe you kind of circle back and they can revisit the menu to continue with your analogy. And they can use those tools they've learned about agency such that they can make a selection. But it starts a little bit further downstream or down the rabbit hole where they need to be pushed a little bit such that they experience the benefits of agency. Is that a fair way to characterize it?
Yeah, it's
or what's missing?
I mean, just given a kind of more familiar model. So let's say that you like imagine three gymnastics studios, gymnastics gyms where children come, you know, after school or something like that. And one of them, it's like not that different from like a jump park. Like the students are jumping around on trampolines. There's a bunch of equipment. They play with things. Some students learn, like the most ambitious students learn some things. Most students just mess around for an hour on the equipment and get out their energy until their parents come. And everybody's happy with it because the children are happy. But, you know, the learning is limited. In another one, it's like, this is where you send prodigies to get trained to be Olympians and like drills. Like when you come in, it's drills and it's serious. And like, yeah, like there's, it's not like totally unfun because the children that are there, you know, have encouragement and they try to get inspired, but it's like not really front and center. It's more like there's a system that you're working through and the system is what makes great athletes and like, you know, live up to the system. Like, I don't even know what gymnastics gyms are like. I'm just imagining there are, you know, there are music schools and other sports that are like this. So I'm imagining that gymnastics has examples like this, like ballet, like the most authoritarian ballet class. All of this. I mean, there's this great video that you should all look for. It's an instructor, it's a famous parkour guy showing a child, like a 10 or 11 year old, how to do a backflip in an hour.
I think I found this video through you.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, I don't know what the context was with this boy. I don't know if he came in saying like, I don't care about anything else. I just want to do backflips. Or if he was like, backflips are one of many things that he was excited about, or he was generally excited about gymnastics and he was hung up on backflips. But, the instructor really gives him an individualized, really expert task decomposed step by step where he really does learn how to do a backflip in an hour. And like, you can see like he's getting better and he's excited that he's getting better. It's like broken out. First, he's just jumping up and down and then he's like doing a back roll and he practiced kind of each part in separately and then they start to come together. That structure where like there's something that you're excited about that you're inspired to do and there's a lot of structure around helping you to learn it really effectively. That's the Montessori structure. And so imagine that for learning how to read. And I mean, young children don't, I mean, Montessori teaches kids how to read before they even know that they want. I mean, so the sound games start at 2 years old. Like, so you say, I mean, games like, you know, I Spy with My Little Eye, something that starts with a puh, you know, and it's like, oh, a plate, you know, that times like 100. So kind of sound games like that on crack are everywhere in the Montessori toddler environment. And so children get really good at phonemic awareness. And then separately, they're practicing muscles that are relevant for writing. They're kind of arm muscles and holding up their arms and how they clean. Their finger, their pincer grip muscles, their pencil grip muscles, and how they're holding puzzle pieces and other things. And then there's a zillion things like that. And so, and all these things independently are things that children are excited about. They want to use the puzzles with the little grip. It's fun for them. Little grip is, it's like a different color. It jumps out. It's like fun for them to hold. They want to, like, 2-year-olds love washing tables. Like 4-year-olds don't, but 2-year-olds really love washing tables. And so it's like a great age for those big movements and cleaning. And children of that age also, they get into rhymes and sounds and they think it's fun and they think it's fun to make up words and you can feed it in a slightly more structural way. And then all of a sudden when they're 3 and 4 and you're connecting it with this fun grapheme practice where they're tracing sandpaper things with their hand and they're excited about letters because they're seeing them everywhere. It's just, it's like there's this 2 or 3 year process where they're getting the basics of literacy. And it's like the gymnastics coach who can teach you how to backflip in an hour. It's this very structured, thoughtful, inspiring, fun, individualized journey through a task that normally you couldn't learn until much later because it's hard unless you actually get the kind of pedagogical expertise right. Is that answering your question?
Absolutely. And to pull on that a little bit more, can all or most things be learned in that way? Are all things so deterministic and binary as teaching a backflip or reading? Or do you have to build that foundation and it allows you to move into more kind of probabilistic or open-ended exploration? Like I'm thinking things like some of the major discoveries that have been made by definition of being major discoveries couldn't have been found through a kind of highly instructed, guided process. So how do you, is there a point at which you make that leap into more kind of open-ended exploration? And what is Montessori?
I mean, I think if you think about elementary school, there's this really good paper called something like A Mathematician's Lament. It's this mathematician who's just like, I just don't understand what happens in math education. It's basically, it's just like, it's a bunch of problems and you work through them and you learn the steps and the concrete calculations and like, it just has no relationship to what mathematicians do. Mathematics is this thing where like there are conjectures and like you can relate different areas of math and you've got problems where you have to decide what the tools are to solve it. And the quantities are very real, even though the relationships between them are very abstract. And I can't remember who wrote it. But it's like when you read it, it's just so devastating. Even if you don't know math that well, you're just like, oh yeah, like we've really effed up math education in such a big way that we can't even see how messed up it is. That kind of thing in every field is a big problem, which isn't to say that I think that education needs to be exactly like when you learn how to do math, you're doing what mathematicians do, but it needs to be a lot more like that and kind of ramping up to that kind of thinking than it typically is. Typically, it's like very worksheetified. You know, it's like you're working through worksheets or working through a textbook, you're learning how to do steps. I mean, even when I get very bright college students who have been through public or even good private schools, like they want to know what are the steps, like how to, like what, tell me what exactly to do. They want to know the Turing machine algorithm. And a good education should teach you the Turing machine algorithms, but it shouldn't be centered on them. It should be centered on their use, which involves some flexibility and discovery and creativity and the possibilities for interrelation and integration. That has to be systematized and has to be part of education. So I don't think it's like, you know, you memorize the periodic table and you memorize the scientific method. Then one day, like when you're a postdoc, like you can have a discovery of your own. It's much more gradual than that. It's much more like, think about how to structure the learning of chemistry such that children, like you're giving them cooking exercises and they're noticing things and they have questions. It's kind of very structured discovery learning process where they feel creative and involved and are creative and involved throughout. But it's still like, you know, you're still learning the atomic theory. Like it's not just like maybe you'll learn that if you happen to discover it. It's like it's still directed in that way. I think that a lot more things can be learned like that than are recognized. Most areas of human knowledge have not had a good pedagogue sit down and systematize it. So my wife was pointing out, she was reminding me of this Paul Graham essay called, I can't remember what it's called. It's like what to learn in a startup are the hardest things about a startup. But Paul Graham is this, he's like, you know, this like meta founder. He's funded as many or more founders than anyone. And he's been instrumental in creating this founder culture. And he surveyed the founders that he was funding in terms of like, and Paul Graham also has a lot of writing. He's like, these are the things that are hard about startups. He's got hundreds of essays. Maybe not hundreds, but over 100. And he surveyed his founder and he was like, what problems did you face that were unexpected? And he thought he would be like, oh, like this will be fuel for new essays and we'll kind of restructure the mentorship program around these things. And every single thing that people told him was something that he had written about. And I mean, that is very normal where it's like, there's some things that you got to learn by experience. And like, you know, somebody told, like, you had Paul Graham tell you a million times, like, do things that don't scale or like focus on the users or whatever. And then like, you're in the weeds and you're like, oh, I just rediscovered from first principles that I should do things that don't scale. I wish somebody had told me that. Oh, wait, there was an essay about that. I should have known that already. Right. Like that kind of like experiential knowledge is very common, especially in complex fields like that have a human element or a creative element. And it's not like I think like that means that why Combinator and PolGram are terrible educators. I don't think that. But I do think that, is there a way to teach that kind of thing more reliably such that you're not just learning it, relearning it a year in, and, you know, it's not quite as painful? Probably right. There is, you know, and that, and every field is like that. It's just like, we haven't really cracked the nut.
Is that more of a human nature problem or an educational design problem? It's, as with all things, it's probably somewhere in between. But sounds like you have a belief about its ability to be solved through education. But like you said, there's fewer new problems than we like to think there are. We've had millennia of human experience that can inform present decisions, and yet we still seem to make the same mistakes over and over again.
I mean, I think a lot of things are instructional design problems. I mean, I do think that there is a human nature problem in terms of understand, like, whatever you teach has to align with human nature and kind of bring out the best of human nature. And that is not often, people often don't even ask that question. But mm-hmm. I mean, most education is like not that different from ordinary communication. It's just like, we're having a conversation and I'm trying to explain something to you. And in a good case, it's one-on-one. So I can get a lot of live feedback. This is why tutoring is so effective. I can get a lot of live right. feedback from you and see what's landing and what's not and really, really tailor what I'm saying to you. But that is, I mean, there is a way, there is a thing called pedagogy, which involves a lot of observation of children and task analysis and research and refinement and engineering curricula and seeing how they do it amongst different populations and seeing which ones are inspiring and what the prerequisites are and how that links up to developmental psychology. I mean, there's a whole field here, and that whole field is about 100 years old. It's very young. I mean, 100 years. I mean that as like an insult to the field. It's like, you know, I mean, it's like in the, you know, medicine, you know, in the 5th century AD or something like that. It's like, we know how to set a bone and we know how to do certain things, but man, you do not want to go to the doctor. Like, that's kind of the state that education is in, because it's going to, like, we don't actually know that much about it, and it's going to be painful if you want to learn something. And I think reading is an area where basic literacy is an area where we've done a lot of good work, a lot. And then there are specific areas, often outside of the typical school system, like music education, where there are people doing good work. That's it. I don't think, like, I've never seen like a killer management school or a great K-12 math program that I thought was really stellar. I mean, there's the stuff that we're doing that I think is kind of making progress, but I mean, there's a lot of things to be done.
Is one of the issues here kind of our ethical aversion to experimentation? And there's this weird thing about science of education where it feels unethical to want to experiment on children and potentially negatively impact the individual down the road for the embetterment of the masses down the road. And yet it's happening anyway. We're always experimenting. But do we have like a general aversion to experimentation with education, and how do you maybe push back on that or reframe experimentation?
Yeah, I don't think it's exactly as you put it. Like, it's not like it can't get past an IRB board, and therefore it's like, it's more like education is kind of conservative for structural reasons, not politically mm-hmm. conservative, but just like it's slow to change. So, you know, just this kind of dynamic where a parent is like, well, what I did, you know, I didn't love every second of it, but it worked okay. And I learned a lot. And in retrospect, some of the things that I learned were really important. Like, I want my kid to have the same experience, like that kind of structure where you've kind of accommodated to your experience and you have trust in it because it happened to you and you want your child to get something similar. Is a deeply conservative dynamic in education. There's also the fact that a lot of newfangled things that people have invented in education are like, they suck. Like, there's a lot of, you know, supposed innovations that are worse and that are like worse than like lectures and textbooks. And so like you get the kind of traditionalist urge has more plausibility in education, where it's like, why is my kid spending 4 hours a day doing discovery learning and building paper airplanes and acting things out? Can they like please memorize their multiplication tables? Like that is part of it. And then at the parent level, yeah, I think that there's like, there's a certain kind of parent that's like excited to send their kid to like a lab school.
Yeah.
But that's not most parents. Most parents don't love, even parents who are pretty forward thinking about education don't love, that's like a lab. Like, don't you guys know what you're doing? You know, that's their kind of initial reaction. And a lot of times my like less than comforting response is like, nobody knows what they're doing in education is like, you know, is not especially right. reassuring. And then that hits the other issue where it's like, but I went to a school where people knew what you're doing. I'm like, no, you didn't, you know, but like, you can't really have that debate with your customers. And so you have to frame it in a different way and kind of be a little bit more conservative in certain ways. So yeah, it's hard to run experiments in education. Education research is also typically constrained by, like most 95 to 98% of education research happens within the context of traditional public schools. Right. Like, it's like you get a class of fourth graders doing math and you give them intervention engine A and give the control group intervention B and you compare them. But all that is happening in the context of like a day and a structure and a social environment and an assessment framework and so on that like you're kind of not messing with. And I tend to think that that kind of experimentation, which is the most common kind of experimentation, is like of pretty limited value.
That marginal experimentation. Yeah. Would you say, I think you tweeted out a while back that you still even think when we're thinking holistic or kind of net new innovation within education and maybe ed tech in particular, that it hasn't had as much success as we would have hoped. And I don't know if that's from a business or for-profit standpoint more than it is a, you know, development of a philosophy of education. But if that is in fact true, why do you think we haven't made as many advancements in understanding education and developing a kind of comprehensive understanding of it?
I mean, some of it is the reasons that I just said there's a kind of conservatism in education. There are other structural things. Like I think it really, really kills innovation in education how deeply, it's not just that there is public education and that's most of education. It's the way that public education kind of sets the terms for the debate, where it's like, even if you're a private school, like a lot of focus is on assessments that are kind of standardized and normalized in the public system and are for a pretty typical college path. And some of it is cultural, like the role that college has and everybody going to college. I mean, all of this is dumb. And it's really hard. Like if you're like, yeah, like forget college, like buck the system, like every single parent is like, maybe, you know, like, I don't know, yeah. like I want my kids to like be financially independent and not, you know, live their life as a pariah. But that's the kind of question that you get into when you get into educational innovation. You run up against the whole system really fast, this big system with a lot of bureaucracy and inertia and a lot of kind of social normalization and expectations around it. So that's part of it. I mean, it is hard to make money in education. There's a lot of money in education. There's tons of money sloshing around in education.
Right.
But most of it is locked up in districts and in administrations and bureaucracy. It's usually not, most of it is not spent by customers. It's spent by the state. And so there are kind of incentive issues there. The biggest issue, bigger than either of those issues, is that it's just education is hard. It's a young field. All the things that I've already talked about, like it's very, people who are sensitive to the right philosophical issues and right issues in instructional design are very, very rare. You know, it's like 1 in 1,000 educators, I think, is sensitized to these issues in the right way. We don't just need our Newton in education. We need our like Tycho Brahe's and our Kepler's. Like it needs to be kind of built up as a field.
Over the last few years, in part because of COVID, but I think also because of kind of latent or lagging socio-political concerns, homeschooling has grown significantly. And Montessori, you could argue in some ways, occupies kind of this middle ground between the old way of thinking about education and I'm not sure homeschooling is necessarily new, but it's had a resurgence. What are your general opinions about homeschooling as kind of a solution to getting outside of public education, traditional public education? And then conversely, what are some of your big concerns about it? Why do you think something like Montessori is still preferred to something a little bit more open-ended as homeschooling?
So homeschooling, I think of as, first of all, it's good. Homeschooling is good. It's just good, full stop. Like, yeah, like there are different trade-offs. Yeah, there's things you have to, it's just, it's a good thing that homeschooling is on the uptick. It's good for people to be thoughtful about education and to be willing to do it themselves. And are their parents giving their children a terrible education? Yes, there are people making crazy decisions, but it's a good thing when people kind of like get excited about education and care a lot about it and want to give it to their own children and do it right. There's like two axes, like Montessori versus homeschooling doesn't even make sense. It's like, you know, which is wetter, like green or blue? It's like colors aren't wet. So there's like school in a separate institution, like a building with dedicated professional teachers versus homeschool in a home environment, with amateur, you know, with home teachers, with the parent as the teacher, deliberately professionalized setting. And I'm not meaning professionalized either as a pejorative or as a
sure.
compliment. So it's just that's one axis. It's like, is the education happening in an institution designed for it versus is it happening at home? And then another axis is what is happening in the education? What are you learning? What's the method being used? Montessori is a method. I mean, you can do it at home. You can do most of it at home, at least. I could buy like every single Montessori material and set up my home and have a 3-hour work cycle with my child. And there would be certain things that would be hard because they do rely on a certain social context. But in terms of a lot of what we've been talking about in terms of the basic instructional design theory and how children learn, a lot of that would be the same. I would probably have to be more directive as a teacher in a less socially complex setting. That's one of the downsides. There are plenty of parents that like run little Montessori schools out of their house. They like get 3 other families to join in, and that is a well established, really cool thing that you can do. So, the reasons to prefer a Montessori school are just the reasons to prefer school, which is, if you get, I don't know exactly how to put this point, but let me just put it in an individual way. The education that my children are getting is better than the education that I can provide them myself at home. And they go to a Montessori school. And that, the social environment is better. Teachers know a little bit more what they're doing for this particular age group, a lot more what they're doing in terms of their expertise and familiarity with the materials. I think it's good for them to kind of like, there's a certain kind of power dynamic that exists with children and their parents where the children have to individuate from you, but now you're putting on this teacher hat. So it's a little bit different. There's tricky things about the home environment. It's good for them socially in terms of their separation. It's just along every dimension. It's just like, yeah, I mean, I could homeschool them, but I think it would be a worse experience for them. So, that's not true of everybody in terms of what's available to them and how good they are with their own children and how good of a teacher they're. I could easily imagine a nearby universe in which the best education that I could give my young children would be to dedicate myself to it and do it myself. But that's not where I'm at. So there are trade-offs for sure. But more than there being trade-offs, it's just like there are circumstances and kind of you play the hand that you're dealt. And sometimes that means homeschooling and sometimes it doesn't.
Right. In this context where the role of parent and educator are separate or bifurcated, and of course bifurcated. And of course, there's a ton of overlap there. You're both educators in a sense. How do you distinguish between the two roles and kind of their areas of ownership or their objectives? And again, I think there's enforcement there.
You mean across in line, the case where children go to school? What is the division of labor?
Right. Yeah.
I think that there are there's a kind of natural division of labor where there's almost always more of an academic or structured focus on the learning that happens at school because that's part of the advantage of having that expertise. It's also a place where a certain kind of social learning happens. And in an ideal case, that's very that's being done very thoughtfully, like approach almost in a structured way. I mean, I don't think it looks as structured as learning how to read, but I'm kind of hidden in the, I mean, this is what Montessori calls grace and courtesy. And sometimes grace and courtesy is called the hidden curriculum, where it's like, there's like lessons on sportsmanship and conflict resolution and things like that, that are very embodied and very theatrically and systematically kind of doled out. And then home tends to focus more on self-care, on routines, on a different kind of conflict resolution, on kind of developing interests that, you know, might not necessarily happen at school. Because school is, you know, you tend to get a pretty uniform curriculum, even in Montessori, where it's like, if you've got a child who's like super into ballet and musical theater, as my 3-year-old daughter is, like, maybe you'll have a Montessori school that offers a dance class once a week, but like, probably as a parent, you want to think about, like, how do I foster this interest in a more customized, nuanced way? Like, a lot of the very idiosyncratic values and interests, the kind of capacity to value and work is developed at school, but the kind of specific values and interests often get developed outside of the school. I don't know. I mean, I think that there needs to be, even though I think that this is a natural division of labor, there needs to be a high degree of alignment. It's very easy for parental practice and home practice, or in a school practice, to come into implicit conflict. And this is one of the things that you need to think about as a parent, is like, you know, just making sure that like your basic goals for your child aren't being undermined by the school, which is pretty normal.
And I imagine that's a lot of what drove the interest in homeschooling as well, is differences of opinion about what exactly those aims and values are.
I think it's an aims and value thing. And it's also it's a mixture of like, what is even the purpose of education, which most traditional schools have no conception of. They're like, it's for, you know, vocational, it's getting a job and making money and citizenship and empathy and, you know, academics and critical thinking. It's like everything in the kitchen sink, and there's no coherent, there's no story there. But there's also just the basic competence issue. I think a lot of what's driving homeschooling is just like, parents saw what happened in Zoom school and they were like, I can do better than that. You know, this is terrible.
That's not it.
Yeah.
There are 4 pillars or lanterns to Montessori, or at least higher grounds, kind of instantiation of or interpretation of Montessori. We've spent a fair amount of time talking about knowledge and agency, and maybe implicitly work as well. But I wanted to dig a little bit deeper on work. I don't know if this is just kind of our bubble within Twitter, or I think it's a larger trend around kind of a dissatisfaction with work, or people feeling a lack of meaning or purpose through work. We have the meaning crisis, the great resignation, et cetera. And yet work is fundamental to the kind of holistic development of a child as you see it. Why is work, and maybe you might have to define it to kind of rid yourself of some connotations here, but why is work so important, and maybe how do we help people derive a better sense of whether it's enjoyment or meaning from deep work?
Yeah. So since you brought them up, just really quickly, the 4 pillars are knowledge, like thought, knowing things, on the pursuit of truth, humanism, which we haven't talked about, which is the love of human beings, including yourself, but also like the world at large, and, you know, the capacity to kind of look out into humanity and see the best in humanity. Agency, which we have talked about, the capacity to self-direct, to choose to author your life as you see it. And then the last one is work, which is the capacity to, I mean, most abstractly, it's the capacity to value. So if you think about, I mean, people are pretty comfortable in education with like, can you learn how to learn? Do you have a critical thinking capacity? Like, if you need to figure something out, can you figure something out? There is this thing. It's very hard to teach. It's very hard to know kind of what to say about it in education, but there is such a thing as like general intelligence and reasoning capacity. And we hope that what we provide in education helps with this capacity. I think that there's something similar for valuing, like setting goals that you like, sticking with them, knowing when to pivot, when to not, the sense that effort is worth it, that you can achieve things, that the world can be shaped. The world isn't just there to be accepted as it is, that you can shape the world and change the world. Both on a grand scale, but also just in like I mean, the number of people that I know that are like, you know, oh, my home office is so cold, and they've been saying that for a year, and it's like, you know, you could buy a space heater, right? It's just, I mean, that kind of basic, I mean, I don't mean to make fun of people like that, like, but it's just like, human beings aren't automatically like high agency valuers who spend a lot of time and energy intentionally shaping their worlds to them. They have that capacity, but it's not, it has to be developed. And a lot of what I think happens properly, it is a developmental issue. It's not just a personality trait. It's not just like some people are high agency and some people like setting ambitious goals. Everybody needs to set goals and feel efficacy in pursuing them and achieving them. Everybody needs to shape the world to suit their needs and not just try to kind of luck into a situation that works for them. You know, most people are, I mean, as you said, most people are alienated from work in a very broad sense, in the sense of, not just in the sense of their job. So I think that that's a very important sense, but people are alienated from the kind of choices and effort that are open to them to kind of make their lives better in a million ways, whether that has to do with their relationships or their leisure time or their work or any category of human life. And Montessori believed, and I strongly believe, that when you have that 6 week old and you let them play uninterrupted for 20 minutes, and then you let that fold into making a choice when they're three and being lost in something for an hour, and it's something that they choose and it's something that they love, but they're getting a sense of efficacy, they're shutting out distractions, they're going into focus, and that grows until you're planning your own day and you're excited about the day, until you're looking a week ahead and you've got a complex project, until you're a teenager and you're helping your parents plan Thanksgiving dinner and you're inviting your friends and you're really excited about it, and there's a million things that go into that. And then it's very natural to kind of like go out into the world and like get a job that you're excited about, or have a project or a hobby that you're excited about, or start a company, or not start a company, just be an employee. But like, you know, your job is to keep this accounting spreadsheet right. And like, it's your goal and it means something to you, even though it's just a bunch of numbers. Like, you're excited about making it perfect and right and operationalizing and automating what you can and feeling good about it and moving on to the next thing. And you get pride from that, dignity from that, because that's real thinking and real goal setting and real effort and behavior. Like that most adults who have jobs where they, maybe not most, many adults who have jobs where they are dealing with spreadsheets every day do not feel like it means something to them. And it's a skill to feel like the effort is worth it. It's an emotional skill to kind of see what you're doing as good and to have a story about it that relates to the other things in your life that matter to you. And that skill starts young.
I attended the Rethink Education conference with you. I think it was the first one in New York, maybe a year and a half ago or so. The theme of which, or one of the overarching questions of which, was kind of, what is this conception of the good life that education is in service of or in pursuit of? And at the risk of being redundant and mentioning a lot of the things you already have mentioned, this, it might be a good exercise to kind of synthesize or distill a lot of the things we've talked about in asking you, what is the good life that we're striving for, and what are maybe the different components that you see within?
I mean, the good life is a life where you think your way through your life and you can understand it as needed, and you can change the world around you and change yourself to make everything harmonize and line up, and for it to be a good life as you think about your specific life conception and understand it. So, inevitably, and this is why humanism is the fourth pillar, the good life, like the most remarkably valuable, wonderful thing in the world around us, is us. It's yourself and other human beings, and kind of figuring out how to interleave human beings into your life and work with them and love them and form friendships with them and think about how to organize societies with them is a significant part of any life. I mean, you can imagine a life on a desert island that didn't involve that, but like, that's a kind of ridiculous scenario, and it's a worse scenario than living in the kinds of free or semi-free societies that we have today. Which is a long-winded answer. So it's, living through life is thinking and working your way through life. Thinking about understanding the things around you, forming a conception of what you want your life to be, out of the range of countless possible good lives, like this one is mine, you know, like you're picking, like, I want a family, or I want like, I love music and I want to, you know, develop that. And do I want that to be my job or do I just want that to be a hobby? Because there's other things that I want. All these things you got to think through. And then there's acting to achieve those things, which means getting good at certain things and changing the world around you to have to be a house that you want to live in or be have include friends that can play in a band with you and to have instruments and wonderful, beautiful music and to have, I mean, just all the things, everything that human beings bring into the world. Like, you're doing some version of that for your life in particular, and you're thinking about it and you're doing it, and that's what life is. And I think it's no less than that. I mean, I do think that the kind of less intentional you are and less agential you are, the worse your life goes, but it's also no more than that. I don't think that the good life means you have to be a change maker or like being an artist is better than being a banker or, you know, you got to donate 10% of your money to good causes. Or I think the good life just is you have shaped your world to be the kind of world that you want, and it's sacred to you and beautiful to you, and it works. It works in fact, and you've done it, and it has meaning, and that's it. And you get your 80 years and then you're off.
I think importantly, there's a lot of interpretation, individual interpretation within those ideas of thinking and working, but importantly, those are also verbs or processes. They're like kind of destinations to be reached. So I like how it's both guiding, but then open-ended enough for each person to make sense of it in their own way.
Yeah, when I describe it very abstractly, it kind of sounds like any life could be like that. But there are real failure cases. There are failure cases where, like, you know, a quarter of the country is being taken for a ride by a demagogue, and like, you know, that's bad for the country, but it's also bad for those people. Like, it's just like there's a whole area of life that you can't think about now, or that you're bad at thinking, and it percolates into, it kind of bleeds into other things. Or there's people who like never figure out how to not be alienated from their work, both their jobs, which is very common, but also just like they don't even have any serious hobbies or things that make them proud. There's no kind of sense of efficacy or source of joy in their lives. And that doesn't even have to be a job. That could be like you're a full-time parent, or like, you know, you're a barista and yeah, like you take it seriously, but like your real passion is writing poetry and you never get money for it. Like, most people are not living lives like that, where they're like alienated from their jobs, but they have these other things that they really care about. They don't have things that they care about. And that's not a life fully lived, in my view. So it is not that common to come across somebody who is living wisely and well, who loves themselves and others, who thinks about things and accumulates wisdom and does things and, you know, take setbacks. I mean, it's just like, it's rare to meet a normal person, like even just at the level of like, not a person on the public stage, but just like somebody's got their shit together and like is happy.
Right. Well, Matt, you've been super generous with your time. There's always one question I ask everyone in closing, which is, what's one question you'd leave me and listeners with, whether to think about or act on?
I mean, the thing that I kind of very abstract point that I never feel like I quite succeed in making this point, I've already said it in this podcast, but that I think is really worth mulling, is how much do you think we have to learn in education? How advanced is this field? How much do we have it figured out? How would it compare to other fields in history? Are we like at the stage where we're like building rockets, or are we at the stage where we like don't even have a catapult yet? You know, I ask this question because my view is that people are not aware of how primitive it is and how little we know. And it's hard to, if you kind of really look at the best cases and compare those to the typical case in education, the gap is vast. It's vast. I think it's a very young, only very recently in history that we've even thought of it as a general field, a scalable field in the science. So just like whenever you're thinking about like, what do we know in education or what do I want? I think first and foremost, just recognizing that like, if you're asking questions about education, you are in the Wild West. You're on a frontier. Do not expect a randomized control trial to give you the answers. Do not expect anybody to give you the answers. Like, it's exciting and scary, and that's what the frontier is, and everything in education is like that. So it's not really a, so my question, is that not true? I can turn it into a question.
You're right. No, and it's that is a moving the needle. There is a pursuit worthy of your life's work. There's a lot to be done there. Absolutely. Matt, thank you so much for your time. This was a blast. I've learned a ton.
Yeah, it was really fun. Anytime.